for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Federal authorities arrested a naturalized U.S. citizen at Kennedy Airport last night as he sought to board a flight to Dubai. The man is charged with parking a bomb-laden SUV in Times Square last Saturday. Joining me to talk about the investigation and what some say is a growing threat of domestic terrorism, Ann Kornbluh to The Washington Post, Bruce Hoffman. He's senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. David Cole, professor of law, Georgetown University Law Center, joining us from a studio in New York City. Samuel Raskoff, he's professor of law at New York University School of Law. If you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Ann Kornbluh, I know you've been working on this story all night. Tell us what we know about Faisal Shasad, the man the FBI has now arrested.
Well, from what we've been told, he's 30 years old. He's a naturalized American citizen, recently naturalized American citizen as of last year. And he had recently visited his native Pakistan, where apparently he has a family, and had come back into the country and was trying to leave the country last night when, shortly before midnight, Customs and Border Patrol agents went on board a plane and in fairly dramatic fashion, it sounds like, pulled him off before he was able to fly to Dubai. He is the suspect who's believed to have purchased the car, paying cash, that was left in Times Square. But we don't know exactly what charges they're going to bring him up on. We don't know yet what his motivation is. We don't know what his ties overseas are, if any, to extremist groups, although increasingly it sounds like there may be some. What's been remarkable from the beginning of the story is that it seemed on Sunday as though this were an amateurish car bomb. That was the word that was used. There was a video of a guy walking away, taking off his shirt. It looked like kind of nothing. And by last night, it seemed like it could, in fact, be a very serious case.
Bruce Hoffman, the Obama administration seems to have quickly labeled this as attempted terrorism.
Yes, I think that just as Anne said, initially there was some suspicions that it might have been amateurish. It always strikes me how, with almost unerring regularity, these plots or attacks are described as amateurish, and then we learn, as we have in this one, that they're far more complex and complicated. And indeed, the fact that the police and the federal authorities now believe that there may have been more of a conspiracy. They argue that this bomb likely could not have been built by one person alone, that it may have taken at least 2 weeks to construct. And as Anne described, there's some international dimension to this, including the fact that Mr. Shasad just recently returned from overseas, indicates that it might not be the quote-unquote lone wolf or individual acting entirely on their own.
Samuel Raskoff, what do we know about the device itself?
Well, I think what we know about the device thus far is that it bears more than a passing resemblance to devices that were used in comparable attacks in London a couple of years back. I would very heartily endorse Professor Hoffman's observation that the inclination to label something like this amateurish, I think, is as common as it is misguided. This device surely would not have caused all of Times Square to go up in smoke, but it would have done some very substantial damage, I'm sure.
How much do we know, Ann Kornbluh, about this device?
I'm not quite sure, to be honest. We know that there were propane tanks in the car. We know that there were fireworks. In fact, that was the initial reason that we were told on Sunday that this might not be Al-Qaeda, that it might be someone domestic who could have driven to Pennsylvania, the nearest state where you can buy fireworks in bulk. But beyond that, the device itself, that was the reason it was described as amateurish in the beginning.
And David Cole, what happened was that some vendors on the street actually saw smoke coming from the SUV.
Right. It's yet another instance in which alert citizens helped to prevent a calamity. You go back to Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, and someone saw him trying to light his shoe on the plane. You got the Christmas Day bomber. Another passenger jumped on him and stopped him from exploding his device, and here too. So it illustrates that citizenry being alert can be a tremendous assistance to us.
But tell me what your greatest concerns are about this case and the focus on domestic terrorism.
Well, Mike, I think we always need to be concerned about how we respond to attacks like this. I think, you know, when they don't go off, there's less of a rush to increase government power and the like. There's an understanding that it's important and significant, and it's a sign of a growing threat, or at least a continuing threat. But one of these days, one of these will go off. I mean, in some sense, we've been lucky. The Bush administration was lucky. The Obama administration has been lucky. One will go off, and then yet again, we will be back in the debate where government officials seek more and more power in the name of appearing to do something, not always with very good results.
Bruce Hoffman, your concerns about this idea that more and more greater and greater steps might be taken to prevent just such an attack.
Indeed, they might be, and they might be resorted to emotionally rather than soberly. And this is what concerns me, is I think we've been, in essence, either in denial or asleep at the wheel. I think that we've lost 5 years where we could have learned from the experience of the United Kingdom. And in fact, this attack is almost a carbon copy of an attempted bombing outside of a downtown London nightclub in 2005. Of the experience Britain has had in countering the domestic threat, the radicalization of its own citizens. But yet, I think during the Bush administration, the implementation of the reforms suggested by both the 9/11 Commission and indeed some of the legislation in the Intelligence Reform Act from 2004 were not fully completed. And frankly, I think the Obama administration has been distracted recently, understandably, by the fiscal bailout, by the health care issue, and thus we're put in a position now of having to respond, and perhaps, I think as David expresses, responding emotionally incorrectly rather than of taking this much more preemptively and assessed what are the changing patterns of terrorism, and if there is this shift to a domestic homegrown problem, how do we respond before it surfaces?
And Kornblut.
I would agree with that entirely. I mean, there is a subset of the White House, which I cover full time, that pays attention to national security and to terrorism. That's their sole purpose at the National Security Council. And obviously, there are entire agencies in the government that pay attention to it. But as we all know, for the last few months, it's been nothing but healthcare until just a few weeks ago. And these things are reactive, so that the White House doesn't really talk to us as the press about what they're doing on national security until something like this happens. I will say on the concerns about whether they will do more or less depending on events, we saw after Christmas Day, of course, that they increased the screening for passengers and coming in from overseas. Initially, they increased it pretty dramatically. They've since scaled it back some. It'll be interesting to see what they do now, whether it's surveillance, whatever we find out about this person and his travels to and from Pakistan. But I wouldn't automatically assume that because the bomb didn't go off in Times Square that they won't do more. I, in fact, think they've gotten very scared by most of these incidents because they know that at some point it is going to go off.
Samuel Razkoff, do you agree with Bruce Hoffman that there have been missed opportunities to step up investigations, to step up surveillance?
I do in general, but let me say this as well. I think we've actually come a long way in terms of creating new and important legal authorities. The FISA statute is an example of one. The Attorney General's guidelines that were that were ratified at the very end of the Bush administration, another important step in creating the legal tools that are necessary to engage in the proactive intelligence that I think is required to address a threat of this sort. The challenge now is in implementing those tools. So I think that's the area where we have a lot of growing yet to do in terms of exercising the power that's now on the books.
But what about Bruce's point that we're at a point now where we're close to living the way Londoners are living?
Well, I think the point is exceedingly well taken. Indeed, my kind of takeaway from the spate of homegrown threats and attacks that we've been talking about now for the last couple of months and years is that, in a sense, the United States is going down the path of continental Europe and the United Kingdom, which means that there are important lessons for us to be learning from our counterparts in counterterrorism across the Atlantic Ocean. Having said that, there are also some very significant divergences, I think, between the American Muslim community and counterpart communities in the UK and in Europe. So I think we need to be mindful that the lessons can't simply be imported lock, stock, and barrel from the UK.
David Cole.
Well, I think that last point is critical. Very big differences between the U.S. Arab and Muslim communities and those in Britain, for example, or much of Europe, where the Muslim and Arab communities are often lower class, disaffected, not integrated into the general society. By contrast, here, the Muslim and Arab communities in the United States are, on average, better educated, more professional, earn more than the average American. I mean, they're quite well integrated. And so we haven't had anything like the kinds of threats that that the UK has had.
David Cole, he is professor of law at Georgetown University. He's the author of Less Safe, Less Free: Why America is Losing the War on Terror. When we come back, we'll talk further and take your calls. Welcome back. We're talking about the arrest of a man on his way to Dubai last night, Faisal Shahzad, who is alleged to have been the man who left an SUV with explosives in Times Square. Luckily, that car did not explode. Instead, some local vendors spotted smoke coming from the vehicle, warned police, and the area was cleared. No one was hurt. Here in the studio, Ann Kornblut of The Washington Post, Bruce Hoffman of the Wilson Center, author of American Jihad, Why Al-Qaeda is Winning. And also, that article appears in the current edition of The National Interest. David Cole is professor of law at Georgetown University. Samuel Raskoff, professor of law at New York University School of Law. He is formerly the director of Intelligence Analysis Unit at the New York City Police Department. Bruce Hoffman, I want to understand from you what you think we should have been doing in this interim between when the car, the shoe bomber almost succeeded on Christmas Day and now.
Well, let me talk both about the general and the specific. I think, firstly, a lot of the intelligence reforms in the reorganization of our national security architecture after 9/11 has been stillborn and incomplete. The problem is when there is a terrorist incident or event, we know how to respond. We've seen the federal authorities, especially NYPD with its excellent counterterrorism and intelligence units, immediate response. But the question is, who is responsible for identifying the radicalization processes that draw people into terrorist groups and then in interdicting the recruitment of these individuals? It's not clear it's the FBI, who in essence investigates crimes and opens up cases. It's not clear that it's the DHS that seems mostly concerned with border security. The CIA, of course, only has an overseas mandate. And I think the new Office of the Director of National Intelligence, commendably but belatedly, is stepping up to this issue. But again, we're behind the curve. I think more specifically, we could have avoided being behind the curve if we had rather taken the threat of some homegrown problem more seriously. I think for many reasons, we lived in recent years in a state of denial, saying this was a problem that occurs in Europe for the reasons David described. It's not something that can happen in the U.S. I have to say, the British thought exactly the same thing before the July 7th, 2005 attacks. They were proven wrong. I think we could have learned from their lesson. Specifically, 3 years ago, Congresswoman Jane Harman introduced H.R. 1955, a bill that would have set up a national commission to study the radicalization and recruitment process, to look at best practices overseas. It easily passed the House. It never came to a vote in the Senate. Arguably, the last thing we need in Washington is another commission. But on the one hand, 6 years after all now, since the 9/11 commission, and patently the threat has changed. We're not facing a 9/11-type threat of people coming from overseas to this country. Secondly, it seems the only time anything gets done in Congress on terrorism is when we have a bipartisan commission. So that was, I think, a key lost opportunity where we could have been ahead of this and could have looked at this before the threat actually materialized.
And Kornblut.
Well, it's certainly a question, even if nothing has been done about it, that has perplexed this White House as of the last 15 months. The question of radicalization overseas, for one thing, especially as there are continued predator drone attacks in Pakistan, and they worry about the messages that sends. But it's also a diplomatic question. And having had this conversation with some of them, there is no one department. Is it a diplomatic question? Is it a security question? There's no one person whose jurisdiction this is. And even more so when it comes to being a domestic question.
David Cole.
Well, I think it's important to think about radicalization, but I think one of the things that is that we should have learned, at least from the last administration, is that one of the surest way to radicalize the enemy is to refuse to treat them as human beings, to engage in broad brush measures which are seen as targeting a religion rather than as targeting individuals, to sweep broadly and round up thousands, as we did here in the United States after 9/11, who had nothing to do with terrorism. Those are the kinds of things that radicalize people, because they feel that they're not being treated as human beings with dignity. They feel a sense of injustice, and that drives people to engage in more extreme measures. So I think we started out with a very integrated, safe, a very patriotic Muslim community here. We have, to some extent, driven people to extremes by the way in which we responded. So I think in thinking about how we move forward, we have to keep that in mind and realize that acting within the rules will actually make us safer.
And I would add to that only that that's all the more reason that the administration's failure to close Guantanamo Bay has been so distressing to them. Their inability to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York, they've had to back away from that decision in civilian court, is another one that some had hoped would be a beacon of their working within the rules, as you mentioned. And I have to wonder now whether any chance of trying KSM in New York is just completely gone, not that it wasn't already.
Mm. Sam Raskov, we keep hearing from our top-level officials that we are safe, though there is a threat out there. How safe do you believe we here in this country are, considering the fact that it was only by chance that that SUV explosion was halted.
Well, I think that goes to the point that officials are really in the unenviable position of having, on the one hand, to defend the intelligence and counterterrorism apparatus such as it is, and at the same time to prepare the citizenry for the possibility of a next attack. So I think it would be foolish for any official to come out and say that they were in a position to deliver maximum or sort of fail-proof safety. On the other hand, I think the general point that the intelligence apparatus, that the counterterrorism collaboration between local and federal officials is generally speaking working better than it's done at any point since 9/11 is well taken. I do think that's correct.
How many steps, how broad a swath can we create without developing a police state? I think that's, David Cole, something you are particularly concerned about, but it would seem that there's kind of a narrow path.
Well, I think that the rule of law actually gives a government a lot of resources to keep the citizenry safe. You can use surveillance where you have justifiable cause to suspect someone of engaging in wrongdoing. You can use informants. You can attend public meetings. There's a lot that one can do and that has been done. And if you look at our record over the last several years, we have actually brought a number of plots to justice without the bomb going off. Some of them, I think, questionable whether they were really plots pushed by informants, but others, I think, much more legitimate. So I think there are tools, but it's critical that we realize that we can't sort of create a totally safe society. That the first of all, the cost of trying to create a totally safe society would be unacceptable in terms of the freedoms that we accept as critical to who we are as Americans. But secondly, even in a police state, there is no such thing as total safety. I mean, I think part of the problem in the United States is the sense that we have to be absolutely safe and that learning to live with risk, which every law enforcement officer behind closed doors, every national security officer behind closed doors will say that's the key. We have to learn to live with risk, to manage risk. If you say that publicly, as John Kerry did during the presidential debates, you're pilloried. But that's the reality. I mean, you know, you just walk down the streets of New York City and you realize that anybody could do significant damage if they sought to do it. We can't stop every one of them. We have to learn how to manage the risk and to balance our concerns for our liberties and our freedoms and for equality and dignity with our concerns for security.
Bruce.
Well, I agree completely, although the one thing I would say is that it's also a reality that I think it's political suicide if a terrorist attack actually occurs on an administration's watch, for better or worse. I mean, this is viewed as almost a kiss of death in terms of re-election. So I agree with David that there's a degree of unrealistic expectation amongst the American people, and our politicians have to be more honest. And indeed, they have to, I think, have, or our national leaders, I should say, have an ability to look forward and anticipate problems and discuss them without the fear of being accused of hyping the threat so that we can address these things before they occur, not after.
But to what extent can we rely on infiltration, informant surveillance?
Well, we have to be better, given the public demands that they expect their government to keep them safe, at all of these techniques. I mean, as Michael Sheehan's op-ed in the New York Times today explains, now, NYPD has done this not without some criticism from civil libertarians, but nonetheless, I think, and in some cases justified, but they have on a very local level taken a very active role in seeking to address, I think, the problem we face now is someone like Anwar al-Awlaki, an individual who engages in the radicalization of individuals, who was radical even before 9/11, who uses his position in Yemen to reach out not only to the Christmas Day bombers, but other. But how do you counter someone like that before they flee to another country and actually become a terrorist operative?
But Samuel Raskob, how many police departments are equipped, as New York City's is, to carry on that surveillance, that infiltration, that watchfulness necessary?
Well, that's an easy question, Diane. The answer to that is obviously that there's no other municipal department in the country that's as capable or that's invested so much in these kinds of programs as the NYPD has. Let me come back to a point that David Cole made and something that Bruce touched on as well, but I think is quite significant, which is this. As for the question about police state and new tools and using potentially aggressive counterterrorism and intelligence measures, I think we should not lose sight of the fact that our best intelligence and, in a sense, our best counterterrorism, therefore, is engagement with the relevant communities. Now, that's not to say that officials won't have to take some sort of aggressive step or engage in proactive intelligence gathering in a covert sort of way. But in the main, the best sort of intelligence on what's going on within a community comes from that community. This is to endorse David's point that counterterrorism and intelligence need to be thought of as collaborations between officialdom and citizenry, not as an action undertaken by officials that is somehow 180 degrees from what the citizens would want.
But in general, how well would you say, Sam, that local police forces do in their efforts to be trusted within their own communities?
I think they generally do exceedingly well. The main advantage that local police have over federal counterparts is that local police are what are sometimes called repeat players in the community. They're there not simply to investigate the possibility of criminal wrongdoing. They're there to provide, in a general sense, the kind of public safety that citizens demand. They're there to help school kids. They're there to kind of help after a traffic accident. They're there, in short, in a range of roles that cause them to have a kind of intimacy with the community that federal officials simply lack. So I think local officials, on the whole, are exceedingly well positioned to engage in the sort of collaborative intelligence that, to my mind, is the prerequisite for understanding and getting out ahead of homegrown terrorism.
Samuel Raskopf, he's professor of law at New York University School of Law. He's formerly director of the Intelligence Analysis Unit at the New York City Police Department. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to New Hartford, New York. Good morning, Joseph. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I just want to say that Bruce and David's point is so critical. I'm a first-generation Arab American, and we have to start taking a serious step to engaging the community in these Muslim areas of major cities where the lack of understanding of culture and language, if we don't make partnerships and friendships with these mosques, with these community leaders, with these imams, we're going to lose the advantage that our country has had for so many years of being able to assimilate foreign citizens into our country so fully that I fear that we become like London, like most of Europe, where the communities, out of fear, become more isolated and entrenched in their own culture and don't assimilate and take a caring and take interest in becoming a part of America and taking pride in being an American first and then being whatever they are second.
All right, David.
Well, it reminds me, a few years back I was at a small meeting of people who had been part of law enforcement community joint enterprises focused on national security and terrorism from Chicago, Detroit, L.A., New York, et cetera. And one of the FBI agents began his remarks in talking about his experience by saying, when we go out to meet the enemy, I mean the community. I thought that slip underscored how difficult it is and sort of underscores the point that Sam Raskopf made, that in some ways the local police who know the community don't see the community as enemy necessarily, but as someone for whom they're providing a service, may be better suited to do this. But I think you also have to sort of step back and think back to how we responded initially after 9/11. We locked up over 5,000 Arab and Muslims in as quote-unquote terrorist investigation suspects in the first 2 years after 9/11. Not one of them stands convicted of a terrorist crime. We sought out 8,000 young men for FBI interviews simply because they came from Arab and Muslim countries. Not one of them stands convicted of a terrorist offense. We made men from Arab and Muslim countries come in and be fingerprinted and photographed, 82,000 of them, again, simply because they came from Arab and Muslim countries. Not one of them stands convicted of a terrorist offense today. And so those kinds of measures, I think, are send exactly the wrong message and make the community afraid to talk to the police.
Bruce.
Well, no, I think that's exactly right. And I think the changing nature of the threat today shows how useless that sort of broad blanket profiling is. I mean, what we've seen is adversaries who are white Caucasians or petite blue-eyed suburban women, people from Africa, for example, where you don't normally associate a large Muslim population. So what we see in the past couple of years is a diversity of the threat, not only in this country but elsewhere, which suggests that sort of base profiling is not going to work.
Bruce Hoffman of the Wilson Center, he's written an article in the current edition of the National Interest called American Jihad, Why Al-Qaeda is Winning.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com. This is NPR.
Avian conservationists describe Gulf Coast rescue efforts and threats posed to birds by climate change and habitat loss. International attempts to protect migratory paths in the Americas. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We're talking during the break about a new report from the New York Times that says the bomb suspect has been said to implicate himself. What do we know about this, Ann Kornblut?
Well, this has all been unfolding as we've been on the air, but it sounds like that they have gotten him to speak. Presumably, he's had his Miranda rights read to him since he was a U.S. citizen arrested on U.S. soil before the plane took off. But we'll find out more about that, and I suspect there will be some debate over whether that was the right thing to do. We've, of course, sent reporters to the house in Bridgeport, Connecticut, where he was living. So we'll know, I think we'll have a complete portrait of him by the end of today. But the little bit we do know is that at some point he had a wife and, I believe, a child living there with him, but they were no more. The last time somebody knocked on their door, according to some of the reports that we got today, that they were actually back in Pakistan.
I see. All right, let's go back to the phones to Hollywood, Florida. Good morning, Jack. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I'd just like to say that the VIN number left on the engine block was the key tool in breaking this case, I think, by tracking it through the VIN number. And I think the media is kind of sacrificing innocent lives in the future by perhaps educating terrorists about mistakes that they have done with this attempt and to, how to avoid it next time. I mean, the VIN number, the mistake by paying cash for the plane ticket, you know, putting the videos all over the TV. I think these guys also have satellite TVs in Pakistan and whatever, and they're watching these news and they're just laughing at how naive we are in kind of telling them, you know, what kind of mistakes to avoid in future attempts.
Samuel Raskoff.
Well, there's always a danger in an open society that information that might in some sense be productive to the enemy could fall into their hands. But I don't regard the information that's been shared thus far publicly in this case as falling into that category at all. And even when it does, at the margins, I would come back to something David Cole said earlier, which is there's a cost of doing business in an open and free society, and we happily pay those costs when we do.
Here's an email from Alex in Tallahassee, Florida, who says, your guest, David Cole, says it's political suicide if a terrorist attack happens on an administration's watch. But George W. Bush was president during September 11, got reelected. Politicians play into the social shock of terrorist attacks, make them worse by turning society's grief and fear into political capital. This is how politicians gain support, but also how terrorist organizations like Hamas gain support. David.
Well, I think it was Bruce, not me, who said that it was political suicide. My point was it's political suicide to say that we need to learn to manage the risk. And it's certainly true that that a terrorist attack can be used to stoke up fears that can lead people to say, give the executive, give the government more power, particularly when they feel that those who are going to be targeted with this power are not them, but somebody else.
I would only add to that that this administration actually has talked surprisingly openly about managing the risk. I went about 3 weeks ago to Spain with Janet Napolitano, where she looked in a port to look at the port security and the overwhelming number of shipping containers that get sent here. And, you know, I asked her afterwards, how on earth can you be confident we're ever going to screen all of these shipping containers? And her answer was precisely what David said, which is you don't. There is no 100%. And that's something we've heard from across the administration. But on the question about the politics of this, I think it's a great unknown how it would play out. Obviously, Bush benefited, got reelected after 9/11. I don't think we know with this administration what would happen if something were to succeed. Obama's approval on national security has been surprisingly strong. Even when other aspects of his presidency, the economy, have gone down, he's remained pretty strong on national security. So I think it's a great unknown. It is something the White House worries about.
Bruce.
Well, the 9/11 Commission, of course, indicated there was plenty of blame to go around, both with the Bush and the Clinton administration and even further back. I think we live in a different world now where public expectations are higher, and indeed our political leaders have contributed in telling us how safe we are. Indeed, I think 3 months after the Christmas Day plot, it's too late to start saying, well, there's some risk. This is something the administration should have been on top of and championed from the very start. It's a bit late to be saying it.
Bruce, I'm still a little confused and concerned about what specifically more you would like to see this administration doing right now.
Well, I think certainly some resurrection of Congresswoman Harman's bill would certainly be appropriate, that we need precisely the intellectual, the empirical understanding and baseline foundation to come to grips with the threat, which I think is rapidly evolving and changing. Last year, we had 9 incidents or plots that were unmasked in the United States, including the successful attack, tragically, at Fort Hood.
And so what would you have done to not only assess the risk, but protect the country from those risks?
Well, early in the year, the administration cut funding to state and local police forces that would have enabled them to beef up their capabilities, albeit far more modestly than NYPD. I mean, Congress has restored that money, but I think that was an example. Last year, we were very slow to get out in front of a case that involved the recruitment of nearly 30 Somali Americans to go overseas to be trained in Somalia, in some instances by a key al-Qaeda operative. We were in a state of denial for too long that our own citizens were being recruited. And now I think we're paying that price at the moment. Finally, Congressman Wolf from Virginia has also proposed having something of a red team where outside experts would provide alternative scenarios, would express their concern about emergent threats that would reach across perhaps what individual agencies may be doing in the United States government, and provide at least another thought process, another insight, and also push those agencies perhaps even more, either to defend what they're not doing or to point them in useful directions.
Sam Raskopf, what can you add to that?
What I would say is this. The FBI, as of 2008, possesses authority to go out and to collect intelligence proactively, regardless of the presence of criminal predication. In other words, as of a couple of years ago, the FBI has unambiguously become the American Domestic Intelligence Service on top of being America's federal police force. That said, I don't think that the FBI has yet matured in terms of its institutional culture into the domestic intelligence service that it's now authorized to be. And what I'd like to see going forward is to see the FBI increasingly become that agency. And at the same time, I'd like to see more and more local police departments follow the NYPD model, plus or minus, and engage in the sort of proactive intelligence gathering collaboratively with the community that is essential to address this threat.
David, are you concerned about those suggestions?
Well, I think they're for the most part sound suggestions. I think there are risks associated with a number of them. The radicalization research, for example, I think can, if it's not done very, very carefully, can just play into stereotypes that I think don't help us in any way. The expansion of the FBI's mission, while unquestionably important, risks that they'll be too aggressive in going into communities and treating them as enemies in ways that, as we saw after 9/11, are unfruitful. So I don't think there's a panacea, one size fits all. It's going to be something that you have to balance. And I think my only hope is that we have learned from the mistakes of the prior administration, as the UK learned, I think, from their early mistakes in dealing with the IRA, to respond in a more sane and less xenophobic and less liberty-curtailing way.
And do you think there is a decided difference between the Obama administration's approach and that of the Bush administration?
I think in intent, certainly, and in overall 30,000-foot message, there is. President Obama, while not a Muslim, has given a couple of big speeches, noticeably from Cairo, trying to reach out to the Muslim world. When he goes to Indonesia later this year, he's going to do it again. The whole tenor of the administration is that they want to be friendlier to the Muslim community, both here in the U.S. and around the world, in part in the hopes of stopping some of this radicalization. But in their approach to terrorism, again, their use of drones, their inability to close Guantanamo, in some of their actual practices, they haven't been able to break with the Bush administration. And they would say they shouldn't, because that's the only thing that's going to prevent a future attack.
All right, to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, T.A. Hello, T.A., are you there?
Hello?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning to your guests.
Good morning.
I just want to say this very quick. I'm a Muslim. I lived in this country for years and years and years. I really believe it is time for everybody in the world to fight terrorists, mainly Muslims and Arabs. I think we owe it to the world, we owe it to this country, and we owe it to God. I mean, what really surprised me the most is I'm waiting for a day where I can wake up and see kings and presidents and leaders of the Arab and Muslim worlds denounce terrorism and do something about it. We cannot depend and count only on the U.S. government, FBI, CIA, to do something about it.
Sam Raskopf.
I think that's exactly right. For very good policy and possibly also some legal reasons, the United States government ultimately is not the right source for an intervention into the thought world of Islam and for a policy of counter-radicalization. A successful regime of counter-radicalization in the kind of in the fullest possible sense of that term has to come from within Islam.
All right, to Carrie, North Carolina. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. I just wanted to reiterate something I heard earlier from a gentleman who had called regarding the media and information that's dispensed regarding some of these events that occur. And upon watching the news, there was an animation of how this object was put into the car or the vehicle and what was done and how, in fact, if this was done, this would have occurred. I just think that's just too much information that's being dispensed to the public, regardless to whether it's to the terrorists or to people who may have a similar dislike about something and want to do harm towards people. That educational science lab type stuff is very dangerous.
And Kornblut.
Well, I would say as a member of the media, we understand that concern, certainly, and nobody wants to be giving a lesson on how to build a bomb, but we do take our responsibility to tell everyone what happened seriously, and people want to know what happened. And when there's a claim that it was an amateurish bomb, we want to be able to either confirm or dispute that. But I think anybody who wants to, and we've seen this over and over, anybody who wants a bomb-making lesson can simply go to the internet and get something far more effective than what we might put in the newspaper or on TV.
And to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Melissa. Melissa, are you there? Well, she was wondering about the use of the word amateurish and whether somehow that provokes people to assume that these folks don't know what they're doing, David.
I think that is part of the concern, but I also think that there's a reality, which is that, in fact, amateurish bombs could do tremendous damage. It doesn't take a genius to build a fairly simple bomb and do lots of damage if you want to do it. So, I don't know whether this one was amateurish or professional. I don't know whether he was acting alone or acting in conjunction with Al-Qaeda or some other group. But I do think that it's important to realize that this is a risk that we face, not just from professional terrorists, but from crazy people who just want to do harm.
David Cole of Georgetown University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Bruce, I'm wondering about the man who dove his plane into the IRS building. Would you consider that an act of terrorism?
I think that indicates that we really enter a gray zone in many respects. Here you had one lone individual, not part of a broader conspiracy, at least that we know of, not belonging to any group, but clearly had written a political manifesto and attacked a U.S. government target. So I think this is very emblematic of how the threat of terrorism is changing. A decade ago, we knew who the terrorists were and what they wanted. They were an organized group. They issued communiques. Sometimes they even warned of attacks. They explain themselves these days, and I think this goes to the amateurish question. We want to believe that the threat is from the professional 9/11 terrorist, because then we assume we can somehow identify them or anticipate them. When we have a threat that is coming just from ordinary citizens who can acquire the wherewithal to build a bomb over the internet, can radicalize themselves or be radicalized in ways we can't predict, that presents much more of a threat, because who do we look for?
So you would put the Timothy McVeighs into a separate category?
No, I would put Timothy McVeigh probably into the terrorism category. I mean, he was part of a conspiracy. He certainly had a political motive. The IRS pilot, though, I'm less clear about. It's not clear that he was part of any conspiratorial movement. I mean, just like one person does not make a political party, I'm not sure that one person operating entirely on their own profound hatred or anger towards the United States government qualifies to them as a terrorist.
Sam Raskoff, would you agree?
Well, let me get past the kind of the terminological nicety and get right down to the point. An intelligence apparatus needs to concern itself with threats, regardless of where the threats are coming from. I don't take it as the responsibility of American intelligence to focus exclusively on threats that emanate from a certain community. That would be very poor risk assessment and very poor risk management indeed. So I think the government needs to focus on all threats, regardless of the ideology or the politics that happen to be motivating them.
All right. And finally, to Boston. Tariq, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I'm a Pakistani-American and horrified on a daily basis by the front page of the New York Times and what's been going on. I have a quick question. My question is that the vast majority of Muslims and Pakistanis that I know are completely secular, and they don't frankly care about what's going on with in northwest Pakistan or Afghanistan or Palestine. And these people are completely shunned by Muslim countries, and people here in the West don't even know that they exist. So my question was that should these people be leveraged to make broader changes in the Muslim community that are more positive than what the government is doing right now by going to Muslim leaders?
Bruce.
Absolutely. Indeed, I think far more Pakistanis have suffered from this variant of terrorism by a minority of people in that country than probably any other nationality.
Bruce Hoffman, Anne Kornblut, David Cole, Samuel Raskoff, thank you all. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.